Hello, this is Best Practice, the RN show about getting stuff done at work. I'm Richard Adie. Today, we wrap up our series, Recruiting Outside the Box, which is about getting diversity into the workplace. In part three, Anne Arnold zeroes in on what's being done to achieve it. That's later. Perfectionism. Is it something to aspire to, or does it get in the way, causing problems not only for the individual, but the people they interact with? If you have a real perfectionist in your midst, you know it can be harmful, perhaps even toxic. So how do you deal with it? Brad Johnson and Dave Smith are with the US Naval Academy's Department of Leadership, Ethics and Law. Brad's a clinical psychologist and Dave, an active duty naval captain, is professor of sociology. Together, they've been researching personality, mentoring and the perils of being a perfectionist. But how did they get interested in the subject? Here's Brad Johnson.
One of the things that you find that connects mentoring with personality is the issue of the obsessive compulsive personality. And the OC person often is excessively devoted to work. They're anxious. They're concerned that their performance is inadequate. They don't seem to enjoy the work they're doing, although they're overcommitted to it, and often make work miserable for other people as a result of their kind of perfectionistic demand for flawless performance. They're often known as micromanagers to people who work for them. And so when you set about trying to help or mentor somebody like that, it can be a real challenge. And one of the real issues is they often won't be very forthcoming with you about areas where they need to develop, areas where they might not be perfect, as it were. And so it can be a real challenge to try and encourage and push them ahead, encourage them to be human and search for excellence without demanding unrealistic standards for their own performance. So that's really what got us started on this.
You will have encountered this many times, but even I've encountered it, where you meet people and they see being a perfectionist as a badge of honor. Certainly that's how they, I'm a perfectionist. As it, you know, like, you're not a perfectionist, so I'm obviously superior to you, but you don't see it that way.
Right. Well, no. And in fact, all of the research on perfectionism shows just the opposite, that if people are successful when they are perfectionistic, they're just lucky. Because for most of us who are perfectionists, being perfectionist actually harms performance. It takes away from enjoyment. You also stand to have a greater probability of having depression and anxiety and dissatisfaction, relationship problems. Some perfectionists get so distraught by their lack of perfection that they actually feel suicidal at times. So the whole notion of good perfectionism, positive perfectionism, is really an oxymoron. And I think that has been a profound disservice when people sort of laud or venerate the pursuit of perfectionism. So Dave and I are tackling that and raising the data, which shows that, you know, perfectionism mostly gets in your way.
Brad was just saying, you know, that we know that actually being a perfectionist is not a good thing. But I think a lot of people associate being a perfectionist as somebody who's like, who wants achievement and is striving for excellence and setting high performance standards. Now, they are good things.
Absolutely. And I think that's exactly what people confuse, as in the exact word that you use, excellence, I think is a great one that we often talk with our students about. And excellence is honing skills, right? And improving yourself and working towards improvement. I think of it in terms of a lifelong learner pursuit. And I think that's something that we should all develop and hope that we would be doing with our mentees out there as well. So we would differentiate that, you know, perfection unattainable, but excellence is something that we should all be striving for and improving ourselves and becoming these lifelong learners.
So you actually go further, you and Brad, and say that perfectionism, being a perfectionist, it's actually toxic. And there's sort of two parts to that, aren't there?
Absolutely. You know, as Brad was talking about there, so it can be almost debilitating to some extent. Brad and I approaching this from a mentoring perspective in particular is recognizing that in the people that we're working on and developing them and showing them that it's okay and acceptable and even maybe even role modeling and demonstrating this in a variety of different ways. One of the things that we see from a mentoring perspective, if you're working with somebody who, again, exuding these perfectionist attributes is that they themselves have a lot of these almost impossible standards and expectations that they're setting for themselves. And it's really easy, even as the mentor, to fall into that trap of also doing that for them. And again, you're facilitating it in that way if you're also setting those impossible standards. And the other part is a very critical aspect that we talked about before, and that you're constantly, you know, criticizing oneself for that. And you can also find this, you know, with the mentors, again, with mentees, where they can be very hypercritical about that because you're trying to reach, again, this unattainable or impossible standards that are being set for oneself.
Is it nature or is it nurture? Where does this come from, perfectionism?
What we really find is the best model that explains this is the biopsychosocial model. And, you know, there's great evidence showing this runs in families. You know, there could be a genetic component. It tends to get passed on. And there are two mechanisms there. One is, you know, probably a genetic connection or link that you're powerless to avoid if you come from a perfectionistic family. But then there's also the role modeling. So if I've got a perfectionistic parent, that behavior tends to get passed on to kids. And that's, you know, a toxic experience sometimes for those kids. Not only are the parents role modeling perfectionistic, unrealistic demands, they're often critical of their own kids when their kids are not perfect or don't seem to measure up. And it may come across as something just like subtle disappointment, but children really pick up on that. Mom or dad is disappointed in me. And, you know, I've failed. And so kids can really internalize that in addition to all the genetics. And then there's the cultural piece. Are you in a context where people demand unrealistic performance from you? The best example from the perspective of Dave and I is the experience of women. There are an awful lot of pieces of research on gender showing that women often are more vulnerable to perfectionism because of the experience they have at work. So the context matters. There are a number of biases for women. One is the prove it again bias. So women often have to prove over and over that they're competent. Guys get a free pass based on potential. Women, they get evaluated and scrutinized terribly simply because of their gender. And if a woman blows it or makes a mistake at one point, everyone remembers it. It tends to carry forward and follow her. When a guy blows it, people tend to forgive and forget it. You know, again, they're evaluating him on his potential. Women often feel more like imposters than men in work environments, especially where there aren't many women. So in that environment, women can easily feel more pressure to be perfect and never make a mistake. That ratchets up their anxiety. It ratchets up maybe some compulsive devotion to work, and it really diminishes their enjoyment of the work experience.
Okay, so the two of you, Dave, have come up with some strategies that you could employ if it's your job or if you're mentoring someone who is a perfectionist. What are the, I suppose, the simple steps that we can take?
Well, so going back to standards again, one, being realistic about standards, and this again, if you're mentoring or working with someone, is understanding what their capabilities are and what they're trying to achieve, and then making sure that you're setting realistic and helping them to see where they're setting realistic standards, right? So they don't come back, and then if they don't achieve, and then they're back to self-criticizing again about the fact that they didn't make it, and getting into this endless circle. I think, as Brad said, I think with women in particular, affirming that they belong, so they can help defeat this prove it again bias or these other biases that often token groups experience, that they're an imposter in some way, and that also that they may be experiencing the effects that, hey, if I fail, that represents, you know, all of my group. So, for example, for women in the military in particular, often they're told that they have to attain perfection because any sort of failure then reflects poorly upon the entire group, not just them. The other part I think that, you know, Brad and I talk about a lot is coming back to us as mentors, that we need to be held accountable and responsible for ourselves. And hey, look, we need to make sure that, hey, if you have perfectionist tendencies, and a lot of us do, that we need to make sure that we're checking those at the door before we start working with our mentee about this. And part of that, if you do have those perfectionist tendencies, is maybe to come out and talk a little bit, be very forthcoming about some of your own flaws and the way that you see things, so that, again, you give them permission to not be a perfectionist and to show how that's helpful and useful.
I would like to give my mentee, who's a perfectionist, some assignments to do less than perfect work and realize they're okay and they survive that. So could you start by just sending me an email full of typos and then not correct them and tolerate that, and don't tell me you're going to do it. Just do it out of the blue and see if you can tolerate not being perfect. So I'd like to use humor. I'd like to use Socratic questioning. I would like to come alongside them and do it in a way that makes them feel supported. But I'm not going to shy away from calling them on it. But it's the way that you do that, I think, that's important.
Is this something that always has to be managed and thought about? Or can you actually, in a way, help someone move away from being a perfectionist?
Yeah, I think you can. I think that the perfectionist is going to find out themselves that there are costs associated with this. So I don't think this is an issue. You know, you may be working with a mentee who's just really compulsive and striving for excellence, but they're not really perfectionists. I think if they're a full-blown perfectionist, you are going to see symptoms of that. And I think the things you're going to see are some depression, some anxiety, clear lack of enjoyment in their work, relationship issues with other employees at work, because they're micromanagers and because they don't have, the ability to join with others in seeking perfection, but not demanding, or in seeking excellence rather, and not demanding perfection. So there are going to be consequences. And I think that your job as a mentor is going to be to help identify those. I notice you're not enjoying your work. I notice that you're late all the time turning in stuff that is due because you have to get it just right. And I'm your mentor. I'm going to tell you that this is going to wreck your career if you can't address this. So I'm going to point it out to you because I care about you, and I'd like you to be able to walk away from that a bit. And, you know, there's some ways I can help you with that, but you have to be willing. You have to be a partner in confronting that.
Brad Johnson and Dave Smith from the U.S. Naval Academy's Department of Leadership, Ethics, and Law. I spoke to them via Skype. You can find details of their book, Athena Rising, How and Why Men Should Mentor Women, along with their HBR article on how to mentor a perfectionist. They're both on our homepage, abc.net.au/rn. This is Best Practice on RN, the ABC radio app, wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Richard Adie. Employers are in a race for the best diverse talent. That means they have to get creative when it comes to advertising and with what they offer once new staff are on board. In this third and final episode of our series, Recruiting Outside the Box, reporter Anne Arnold looks at the art of diversity recruitment and inclusion.
This is a meeting of Westpac's Committee for Cultural Diversity and Leadership, formerly known as the Asian Leadership Group. It's chaired by Yung Nyo.
In our last committee meeting, we started the conversation around our priorities this year and where we're going.
Behind the committee are more than 1,600 members of the group, employees of the Westpac, St George and other affiliated banks. It's a busy committee. There are language classes for cultural awareness.
So the Chinese Language and Cultural Group has already finished its second rollout of the Chinese classes, where there are three classes. We're very fortunate where each student were matched to a mentor. So basically,
and a leadership summit.
Yes, that's right. So I've reached out to other folks within the Westpac group, trying to leverage some of the other summits that's been run already, such as the Youth Network. Because that
one of the group's roles is as a de facto internal recruitment agency. This is Yung Nyo.
One of the business units that we're helping at the moment is all around recruitment. That said to me, actually, before we even talk about the opportunity to develop and promote diverse talent within our business, we've got an issue around trying to attract diverse, culturally diverse talent within the business in the first place.
The group is one of eight employee action groups at Westpac, providing platforms for promoting particular interests. Yung Nyo says it's partly about making Westpac attractive to a wider range of employees.
A big part of it is really positioning and recognizing Westpac as an employer of choice for people from culturally diverse backgrounds.
Employers are getting innovative about how they do their diversity. And that's driven by the market, according to Associate Professor Ray Cooper from the Sydney University Business School. Employers are competing for the best talent.
Our workforce looks at organisations and tries to choose who they work for on the basis of indicators such as diversity. And in order to, you know, attract a talented workforce, I think that's compelling a lot of action in this area.
The first steps are finding the people and introducing them to your organisation.
Good morning, everybody.
Good morning.
Hope you had a lovely trip in.
In part two of this series, we met Cherie Oliver, the ABC's tour coordinator at our Sydney headquarters. Cherie came in on a temporary six-month position, filling behind the permanent tour coordinator. It was a targeted Indigenous position, a chance for someone to try out the ABC. So that's one way to open the door. Philippa McDermott, the ABC's head of Indigenous Employment and Diversity, says her team has to think creatively to attract people.
So our recruitment has really changed. The way we advertise things, where we advertise, the language that we use. We're using social media a lot. You know, we're going to where the people are, really. And Indigenous people aren't coming to the ABC career site necessarily, so we have to go to them. We've got a huge social media following from Indigenous TV, ABC Indigenous TV. So we use them. We use Twitter, Facebook, LinkedIn. There's a heap of, you know, Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people on LinkedIn, which is another great format.
So just use networks. You get people to share.
Yeah, and the Koori Mail, of course, which is, you know, a tried and true, well-tested, you know, place to advertise jobs.
Other organisations are also wanting Indigenous staff, so the ABC has to sell itself.
Yes, well, in our ads, we have to describe the kind of workplace that we are as well. So we have an Indigenous staff conference every 2 years. We have really good retention strategies. We do career planning. We do mentoring and networking. We have to highlight those kind of things that our workplace has that other workplaces might not have.
Employers may be rewarded by rethinking the requisite skills, according to Ray Cooper, who's also the co-director of the Women, Work and Leadership Research Group at the University of Sydney.
If you're in a logistics firm and your top criteria that you're looking for is someone with an engineering degree, now that obviously has a very gendered impact on the type of people who are going to be applying for positions with you. Do you really need an engineering degree to be a senior manager in that type of organisation? Looking at the other end of the labour force, does someone who could perform in a utilities company quite well, do they need a truck licence before they come in, or is that something that actually could be achieved on the job? And by removing those sorts of barriers, do you then allow yourself to have access to a more diverse pool of talented people?
Once people who don't fit the traditional mould are brought into an organisation, there's the challenge of making sure their placement works. Cherie Oliver would like to stay on at the ABC and, hopefully, move closer to the content areas.
I'm genuinely hoping that I could actually stay here, but in a role that actually would assist in Indigenous content programming or something along the public relations, community relations line because of my background of work. I'm hoping that the ABC would be able to embrace an ongoing role for me.
Career planning is a big part of Philippa McDermott's role.
You might want to be the EP of the 7:30 report, well, and you're a junior reporter now, how am I going to get there? Well, that's a longer term goal, but let's step it out, you know, and that's the kind of, you know, work we're doing every day.
Philippa McDermott is a Mulunjali and Waka Waka woman, and she says cultural awareness training for managers in particular is very important, especially when it comes to family obligations that might require some flexibility. What does it feel like when you're not part of the dominant culture of a workplace? Can it be very alienating?
Yes, absolutely. And I think it's twofold for Indigenous people. In certain families, there might be generations of people who haven't been employed. So it's actually about understanding a working culture, understanding what it means to be in a routine and to get up every day and, you know, go to work and the commitment that that is as well. And sometimes broader family members don't understand that. You know, why do you have to be there from such and such a time to such and such time, or work overtime or what have you?
So there's pressure from home.
There's pressure from home and community. And then there's also, you know, getting the employee into the swing of things and understanding how a workplace works as well in the different environments.
Language of meetings, I would imagine.
Absolutely. All kinds of acronyms, languages, and, you know, and understanding the business itself. You know, a place like the ABC is an intimidating place for anybody.
It's all about inclusion, and that's down to the employer. Associate Professor Ray Cooper.
So we hear time and time again when we talk to organisations that, oh yes, we had a woman or we had a, you know, culturally diverse person, and there it didn't go so well. And they then become the sort of the reason why we tried it and it didn't work. The danger with that approach is of bringing an out group, if you like, or a non-traditional person into a role or an organisation without changing the culture in which they're working really does set the entire project up to fail.
Employers might be on the hunt for diversity now, but they're late to the party. Senior staff or leaders are still most likely to be male and Anglo-Australian. At PwC, they're tackling that head on.
Our targets are at partner admission level because we fundamentally believe that to build a diverse organisation, it has to start with a diverse leadership group. And the way to move the dial is to absolutely have targets for our partner admissions every year.
This is Sue Horlan, PwC Australia's managing partner for human capital.
So at PwC in Australia, we have 600 partners. We admit 50 to 80 every year. And in those 50 to 80 admits, we have what we call our 40-40-20 rule. So what that means is 40% of our admits will be women, 40% will be men, and 20% can be either men or women based on business needs in that particular year.
At Westpac, Yung Nyo is the State General Manager for Premium Business for two states, New South Wales and Victoria.
So my personal background is I'm Chinese, born in Vietnam. I actually came to Australia in 1978 as a three-year-old refugee, escaped the war-torn Vietnam.
Yung Nyo says that having grown up in Australia, he's never felt excluded or not part of any work culture he's been in. But he says he has been the recipient of bias or unconscious bias when it comes to leadership roles.
As an example, I've been in retail for a long period of time, running and managing large distribution across the consumer bank. It's interesting, every time I will tell someone or someone will ask me, you know, the simple question of, so what do you do in Westpac? And I said, oh, I work in the retail branch network. The second question would be asked is, so which branch do you work in? You know, there's nothing wrong with those roles in a branch. The default position is that you're not a senior leader, whereas the reality is I actually, you know, run all those businesses and run, you know, the hundreds of branches within those businesses.
Leadership and cultural diversity is one of Associate Professor Ray Cooper's research areas.
All of the evidence would suggest to us that despite us being a nation and a workforce of migrants, that we're doing particularly poorly in terms of leadership and pipeline to leadership for cultural diversity in Australian organisations, from public sector organisations to universities and through to private sector organisations.
PwC has cultural diversity targets for its partners as well as the gender targets. Sue Horlan.
Our second target is around diverse cultural backgrounds. So again, out of those 50 to 80 admits every year, 20% will be from a diverse cultural background. So what that does is drive conversations down through the businesses around pipelining. So do we have a good enough pipeline of women? And if not, what are we going to do about it? What's our diverse cultural pipeline look like in that business? And if not, what are we going to do about it? Because there's absolutely this understanding that these targets will be focused on every year.
Does that also help prevent someone who has not come from a background with where they bring a lot of confidence to the corporate world? It's a very new world for them. They might not be as extroverted or as demanding as some others in the workplace. It stops those people hiding away or being overlooked.
That's exactly what it does. It forces the businesses to reach into their business and find high potential people and then give them the learning and development that they need in time for their admission into the partnership.
That's Sue Horlan, Managing Partner for Human Capital at PwC, in the final of that series from reporter Anne Arnold. That's it for this week. If you're listening to the show as a podcast, please rate or review it. It helps more people to find us. Best Practice is produced by Ian Coombe. Our sound engineer is Anne-Marie de Bettencourt, and I'm Richard Adie.